Welcome to The Fighting Priests, a podcast exploring orthodoxy and jiu-jitsu, two paths, one struggle. Father Ted Paraskevopoulos and Father Thomas Sandberg are two orthodox Christian priests who also happen to be practitioners of jiu-jitsu. Together, they explore how these two unique worlds intersect and what it means for our spirituality. Here's Father Ted and Father Thomas. All right, everyone, welcome back to The Fighting Priests. I'm your host, Father Ted Paraskevopoulos, along with my co-host, Father Thomas Sandberg. We are here today with another really special guest from our friends to the south, the U.S., Father Michael. And he is in Nashville, Tennessee, I believe. And he is a fellow jiu-jitsu practitioner. He's a little bit higher up on the belt. He's a two-stripe blue belt. And he used to live in Rochester, but he'll tell us more about that and where he did most of his training. Now he's new to Nashville, where he trains as well as his children as well, I believe. And he'll tell us more about that. But first, I want to welcome Father Thomas again from up in Niverville, Manitoba. I don't know why I laugh every time I say that. I'm sorry.
it sounds so weird. I guess from Toronto, it is up, but it's really because it's right at, like, it's the southern part of the province. So it's, to me, it's weird to say that.
It's up for everybody, Father Thomas.
Yeah, exactly. But it's good. Good to be here. I just trained this morning, so it's good to be training again. Trained on Thursday and trained this morning, so
that's the first two times you're back, right?
Yeah, today was really good. I think I got in like 5 8-minute rounds, so
nice.
Slowly things are opening up, and I guess phase three here is starting on next week sometime, or the week after, depending what the date is. So yeah,
nice. And Father Michael, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Father. It's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure.
How are things down in Nashville?
Good. You know, it helps that it's really warm down here. So even during the quarantine, you could at least get out and get in your front yard and kind of be outdoors a little. So it's been pretty decent. And kind of like Father Thomas said, stuff is opening up. The you know, gyms are opening back up, and people are out, and traffic starting to get bad again. So it's good to see a little bit of life return.
Have jiu-jitsu clubs opened in Nashville?
Yes, they have. So the jiu-jitsu gyms are open back up, and so they're running, at least as far as I've seen, running about normal now.
Have you had a chance to go train yet?
I've gotten 2 days in. That's all I've gotten back in since things have kind of lifted. So it's a little slower. Knocked a little bit of the rust off because before the COVID hit, I had been on sort of an unintended hiatus. House blessing season, as you all know, is busy. And here it really took from the beginning of January to the end of February to get all of them done, because this area is so big and so spread out. So, I mean, you might, like, let's say you scheduled half a dozen houses in a day, but all the distances are like 38, 48 minutes from house to house. So you're talking to people, you're having coffee, you're blessing the home. And then it's another close to an hour drive time or more if it's near rush hour. So it took basically 2 months to get done. And, then there's COVID, and so this has been a long break, and it was awesome to get back on the mats. Awesome.
Nice. Yeah. It's you know, in the bigger cities, it's house blessing season can kill you, like, completely. It's the same here in Toronto. The distances are not so large. Actually, in some places they are, but it's just the traffic, right? So yeah, it's like, I can schedule, let's say, 15 houses in one day, which is a heavy day, right? You're doing like one, you schedule one every half hour, but you never make it to that. It's always bleeding over, you know, and you're driving, like you said, you're driving most of that, and you don't have time even to spend with people. You just go in and out. I have to go in and out like 5-10 minutes because I just can't get them all done. And it will still take a month and a half to 2 months to try to finish everything. And then, of course, yeah, you want to do your training and you want to do everything else, right? So yeah, the good thing for me was that because my kids are training as well, I forced myself. I said, like, you know, I have to take my kids. So I can't schedule that time. I have to like work around those. So the excuse was, you know, take the kids, you know, get a training session in for myself as well, you know? So, but it doesn't work. It doesn't always work out that way. Nice. Nice. Well, welcome to the podcast. And, today we'll be talking a little bit about resilience. Our title is Winning by Tapping, Building Resilience Through Failure, which is something that for anybody who's trained jiu-jitsu knows that, especially your first year, which is, I'm still in my first year. That's all you do. You just lose all the time. So, it teaches you a lot, and we've spoken a little bit about it on the podcast so far, but we look forward to having a deeper conversation about it today with you.
Okay. So Father Michael, how do you pronounce your last name?
All right. Great. Thank you, Father. Last name is pronounced Mark Antoni. Yeah, it's just consonant vowel. But the length, I always knew when it was my name as a kid in school because the teacher would pause too long. Mm-hmm. She would be like, Lawrence and Johnson, and then they get to mine. And they're like, Mom, right here, that's me. And it's okay. consonant vowel, Mark and Tony. Yes, sir.
So you're not Greek.
No, mm-hmm. I'm not.
Yeah, me neither. But you're in the Greek Orthodox Church?
Yes. So I'm Puerto Rican. The last name is Corsican. There is on the west end of the island in Utuado and Yauco and out that way, you can find some very atypical last names because, you know, Spaniards weren't the only ones who came to the islands. So there's some Corsican and Italian last names out there. Mine happens to be one of them. But yeah, I'm Puerto Rican. My presbyter is from Peru. So we are not Greek. However, we have been warmly loved and embraced in the Greek archdiocese. We just, you know, we're part of the community. It's part of our lives. Our kids have taken and take Greek lessons. And I say some prayers in Greek. It's part of the milieu. So it's, you know, but yeah, no, we're not ethnically.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. I think that's interesting because in Canada, a lot of the priests, a lot of the clergy are of Greek descent. Mm-hmm. So slowly we're starting to get more who are not. So it's interesting to meet another one who isn't as well.
I was just going to say to that note, you know, because I went to Holy Cross, the seminary here in Boston, mm-hmm. and at least presently, at least half of the seminary track students mm-hmm. are not Greek at all. And most of the, over half of the wives aren't Greek. So if you count the wives and the students and even people in the undergrad, over half of our seminary is not Greek. And down here in America, that really reflects the parishes. The parishes are more and more heavily non-ethnic or mixed ethnicity converts and so forth. So it's definitely a more diverse story down here for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's also because, you know, in the States, you're almost like, even the Greeks there, they're like third, fourth generation now. So they're far ahead of the Canadians. In Canada, most of us, we're still first generation. So my parents were born in Greece. Almost all my friends' parents were born in Greece. So we're really behind in just kind of like the cultural evolution. And that's where we're going as well. But it's just we're some years behind, and this is why. At our seminary here in Toronto, which I teach at, which Father Thomas is just graduating from this year, the majority of the students are Greek. I think Father Thomas was the only – actually, maybe there was one other Serbian student, and then Father Thomas is the
two,
only
– Two Serbian students.
Two Serbian students, and then Father Thomas is the only North American, like, you know, Métis background, you know, who's non-European, I guess you could say, right, directly from Europe. And you know, I went to St. Vlad's, so same thing there. It's like 75% was convert, right? Very, very different.
Yeah. You know, it's just the nature of Orthodoxy taking root here, in the Americas, because I mean, really when you say America, the Americas, you're not talking about the USA. That's this whole North and South America. I mean, and that's just the way that is. But, you know, over time, it just becomes a local native thing. And, you know, to that extent, honestly, I don't look at myself as a convert. We don't speak of ourselves as converts. This is just our faith. This is just, you know, when someone asks, you know, what are you? Well, I'm a Greek Orthodox priest. Oh, okay. And if they ask, well, were you always Greek Orthodox? Well, no, the answer is no. I came into it as an adult. But I dislike, at least for me, I dislike sort of the mentality of always thinking of yourself as a convert, because at a certain point, this just has to be your home. It just has to be your faith and your church. You know, if you're always thinking of yourself as, say, a Protestant who converted to Orthodoxy or a Catholic who converted to Orthodoxy, well, that's a problem, because what's at the front of that sentence? Are you still a Protestant or a Catholic, or is this just your faith? And if this is just your faith, then, well, then let's just be that, you know?
Sure.
But I understand, and it's, that doesn't mean it's rosy down here. We have, believe me, there's still a little bit of a Orthodox culture war, but, you know, amen.
So you, let me see here, you're married and you have children? How many kids have you been blessed with so far?
We have two kids, a boy and a girl, Matias and Andrea. Matias is 10. Andrea is 7. She's 7. She'll be 8 next month. So we've been, and we all go to jiu-jitsu together. Presbytera has not quite got bit with the bug yet.
Yeah.
But as much as she yells and coaches them while they're rolling, I think it's only a matter of time, to be honest with you.
Well, that's nice. Okay. Well, how about you tell us how you got into that? Did you start going first, or did your kids go first and then you followed them, or?
So like you always need an excuse, right? So here's the deal, right? So it's a little bit of background because it makes it make sense. And I'll try to rush through that quick because it's probably only interesting to me. So I come from a big military family. And even after my dad got out of the Navy, his civilian job moved us a lot. So I moved around a lot, which meant he didn't make a lot of lifelong friends. I got a couple of people that have stuck with me over the years. So I wasn't really good at team sports as a kid. I always wanted to play team sports. I loved the idea of playing baseball and all that. And I was never good at it. And I was getting picked on a lot and bullied. And I dealt with a lot of bullying. And at a certain point, my dad was like, all right, you need to try karate. And it was 1989, you know?
Yeah.
And so he puts me in karate, and I loved it. And finally, it was like, here's an activity I'm good at. Like, I was good at it. With a team, I was always nervous about letting everyone else down. And I was always nervous about messing up. But with karate, I could just, like, if I did the form right, fine. If I didn't do it right, that was on me. If I blocked the kick, I blocked it. If I didn't block it, that was on me. The pressure was off, and I could just enjoy it. And so I kind of found my niche, and I started making friends. So I was that goofy kid who, like, if mom had me at the grocery store, you know, I would, like, make her buy me Black Belt magazine. Did you guys read Black Belt? You remember that?
Yeah, I remember that magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'd like, that was, I just, we'd have a stack of them in the van with me if we were driving anywhere. And so like, I was a teenager when UFC came out, and it was like every kid's dream, like, man, we're going to find out which style is better, which is the best style. And all those demo reels, you remember the old demo reels? They were so impressive. Dudes are flip kicking and ninja-ing each other. And they got into the octagon, and it was just like flailing dudes and messy wrestling and bad boxing, except for Hoist Gracie. And he was like choking everybody out, and jiu-jitsu looked so cool. But, you know, early 90s, there's nowhere to do jiu-jitsu. Like, it wasn't anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so I always thought it was cool. It looked like something I'd enjoy. The karate place I was at started doing some light grappling, and I was really good at it. That was like, I liked it better than striking. Mm-hmm. But there was nowhere to do jiu-jitsu. So kind of continued, you know, got to be an adult, went to the family business. So that my family, that means I joined the Army during college, you know, served, deployed, did all that stuff. And life kind of happened, and I stopped training, and I still loved it. I still wanted to do it. Went to seminary, and I was serving as an assistant priest down in Clearwater, Florida. And I was getting the my $10 haircut, because that's not only what I can afford, but I'm into high fashion. So I was getting my $10 haircut, and at the cashier, they had these little cards for a Gracie gym that had opened up around the corner. It was like a mile from my house. Mm-hmm. And it was advertising their kids program. And I was like, oh, here's my excuse. Because it's at ages 5 and up, and my son had just turned 5. Mm-hmm. So I went home and I told Presbyter, I'm like, listen, I want to put Matias in jiu-jitsu. He's going to love it. And we're going to do it as a father-son activity. And it'll be a great bonding experience for us. And I'll drop these things out of the budget so we can afford it. So I sold it to her as this father-son thing that we do. And I started working out of my garage, lifting weights in the garage instead of going to the gym. And we made it work. And he did love it. And then, you know, the little one, she wanted to get in there with her big brother. So she was old enough, she got in. But yeah, that's how I got started, right? Like, it had been this thing that I'd been eyeballing since 1993 and never had the opportunity to do. And then my son gave me an excuse to do it. And it's just been on the menu ever since, man.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's great. Have you competed in any tournaments yourself?
Just like maybe three or four times, yeah. Not very often. My son has competed a lot. He mm-hmm. really likes it. I want to do it more. Mm-hmm. My daughter does not want to compete. I'm really hoping that she's kind of at a funny age where she's starting to feel like more social. She's very outgoing, but she's starting to get very socially self-conscious. Like mm-hmm. she was doing Greek dance and then suddenly wanted to stop because she feels like everyone's looking at her. Aww. But she's 7.
Yeah.
You know, so hopefully she'll do it, but she'll train, she'll roll. And that's the important thing. Yeah. For me, I really want to do it. But like after Afghanistan, my nerves were never the same. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I get a kind of anxiousness mm-hmm. around competing. That's like that same, it's something else to work through with those same Afghan nerves. And yeah. I love rolling. I love open mats. For some reason, I can't love competing yet, but I want to love it. I look at it, I'm like, I want to do that. I want to love it. I want to love it the way these guys love it. So hopefully that's something I can just get past and dive forward in. You know, I remember back when I was a kid or back before Afghanistan, I used to, you know, I'd compete under the, and I would look forward to it. I'd be excited. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, suddenly after, you know, this is years after the deployment, but then you get like mm-hmm. this weird nerves and I'm like, oh man. So there's still, mm-hmm. you know, I guess there, maybe, who knows, maybe this is one of those many, healing therapy things that God puts in your life. And then you get stronger, you get better.
Well, yeah, that would be my next question. Do you think that jiu-jitsu has helped you with things like that, with, just overcoming things that you feel might be in your way?
100%. 100%. This is, it's, I can say it makes, on every level, it makes me a better man, a better husband, a better priest, definitely mm-hmm. makes me a better priest. You know, so absolutely. I don't know how much you want me to monologue on that.
It's good. It's okay. What about where you train? What are the people, when people found out you're a priest, how was that? What was that like?
They're usually pretty cool about it. Like sometimes they're surprised. I remember this one day in Rochester, we had just a really, like we went straight into rounds after training. And for the most part, at least, especially in Rochester, for the most part, I had a lot more control as a priest over the beginning of the day, you know, than I do over the end, because when people have to meet with you, it's after work and stuff. Yeah. And so they're wanting to meet in the evenings. So I would take a lot of the morning classes, and we'd have this, you know, kind of a small group, really good group in there in the mornings. And I remember we had this one day, we just had these really tough rolls and we were going 100 miles an hour. And it was just awesome. I mean, we're fighting hard and it was great. And I had this guy and we were really going after each other, and I choked him a couple of times and we were throwing each other. And it was great. It was that kind of fun you have when you're on the mats, you're taking it to each other, but you're just enjoying it. And then, so we're all sweaty and changing out, and I put my clothes on, and I didn't even think about the fact that this guy didn't know what I did for a living. And he sees me slip the collar, the tab into the collar. He's like, whoa, hold on a second. What's going on with that? And I'm just like, oh, yeah. Sorry, dude. Grigor the Dutch Priest, how you doing? But I'd actually, some people from the gym, you know, I've had, I used to, back in Rochester, I put up a lot of stuff on our Facebook and our YouTube. I've been a contributor to OCN for Orthodox Christian Network for the last couple of years. And I actually have had some of the people from the gym up there watch my stuff. And they'll tell me, they're like, you know, hey, we're not churchgoers, but your stuff is really good. And they enjoy it and get benefits. So they're usually pretty cool. I'd say that my big thing is when I'm on the mat, I'm just trying to be another dude. Like, I'm just a guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, I had one person, they're like, do we call you father? I'm like, no, absolutely not. Do not call me father. Cause out here, I just need this space to be a guy doing an activity he loves with some people whose company he enjoys. Like, I'm not here to be your priest. Obviously, if you got questions, we can tackle it, but I'm just here to be another dude getting choked, man.
Thank you for sharing some of your background, Father Michael. That was great. And I identify a lot with what you said, because as I have said this in previous episodes, that exactly the way you got into jiu-jitsu, I got into jiu-jitsu. It's almost the exact same story. Wanted to do it for a long time. Of course, Father Thomas, being my spiritual son, had been doing it since the day he got baptized. And then watching him progress and wanting to do it, but never being able to or never having the ability. And then your kids come along. And then, you know, finances, all this kind of stuff. There's all these obstacles when you're a priest, and it's very difficult. And selling it to my wife, you know, it's going to be a father-son thing. Exactly. It's exactly the same conversation I had. I'm going to have to sacrifice other things to afford it, because it's expensive, right, to train. But it's important. I think it's much more important than anything else, any other kind of pastime that I'm doing or anything else. So I totally identify what you're saying. Kind of going back to what we were talking about before, when we mentioned this idea of, you know, building resilience and being humble and, you know, gaining humility from tapping out. You know, you're a blue belt, I'm a white belt. We kind of like represent the whole spectrum of jiu-jitsu here, because between the three of us, I'm at the lower beginning end, you know, being a white belt. And then you're kind of a little bit up, you're the blue belt. Then we have, of course, Father Thomas, who's a black belt now. And so I want to ask both of you, kind of like, I want to compare and contrast a little bit your experiences of tapping out. Why? Because for you, Father Michael, and this is not a judgment on your ability, but I'm assuming that you're going to be getting tapped out and submitted a lot more than Father Thomas will be. Even though Father Thomas is going to be, he's going to be fighting other black belts. He's going to be fighting other guys for his level. But let's face it, Father Thomas, when you're at the club, you're going to be fighting a lot of guys who are lower than you in lower belts, and you're going to be teaching them. So your experience, I'm guessing, you could tell me, I'm asking you actually, your experience now, having kind of been a practitioner for the better part of a decade, is going to be different as far as, you know, be tapping out and, you know, the idea of being kind of humble through the experience than, for example, Father Michael's experience or my experience. So I don't know. I guess I'll ask Father Michael what his experience is first, and then I'll ask you how your experience is now at a black belt. Because I know what your experience was when you were a white belt, but now it's got to be different. Father Michael.
Right. So I tap a lot. And I've got you can visualize, you know, okay, this takedown should work this way, or, you know, this technique should work that way. You can practice it. And then, you know, in real time, it doesn't always go as planned. And blue belt, you're tapping a lot. It doesn't bother me. I've read a lot of things on jiu-jitsu, you know, read a lot of articles, listened to a lot of people, and it can get some people down. It doesn't bother me at all. Because like, if you tap me, I've fought pretty hard. Like, I make you earn it. I'll make you earn it. I'm going to get tapped, but I'm going to make you earn it. And I'll come back at you. And it's not discouraging, but it happens a lot. And the way I feel most comfortable with my progress is when I notice that with a given individual, I'm doing less. So like my gym back in Rochester, there was a guy that I was really close to, Jason, great, great dude. And he was a high ranked purple belt when I walked in, and I was still a white belt, and he's a black belt now, right? He recently got his black belt before we left. Obviously he's way farther along than I am, but when I could last longer with him, when I could execute more technique, when I could tell that he was really having to exert some effort, I felt better, you know? So I was like, okay, yeah, Jason's still going to tap me, but can we make it more of a fight? I'm really okay with it as a learning tool. I don't mind it.
I know exactly how you feel. I have exactly the same type of partner. He's a blue belt, actually, just like you. I think he's like a third stripe blue belt. His name is Ali, good friend of mine at the gym. And he's actually like, I think just getting into the military now, later in his life, like in reserves. So he's like becoming a military man, you know, and really nice guy. And yeah, I roll with a lot of guys, but I roll with him a lot, and he's really tough, like really hard, but not in a mean way. I always say that he's one of the people there who's helped me along almost as much as my instructors, right? Because, you know, it's not that you gauge yourself just by rolling by that one person, but when you find somebody who's really, really good and you can't beat them, then like you said, you get a little better, or you tap, it takes longer for them to tap you, you know, for you to tap, right? Or it takes, or things that they were doing to you, like he's a great, he does sneaky chokes, right? Like that's his thing, right? And so that taught me to be really careful with chokes to protect my neck, right? I'm a big guy. What do you do with a big guy? You go for his neck, right? Because it's available. It's a vulnerable spot for bigger guys, right? So, because you're not going to go power against power, right? Like, so you know, you learn, and like you said, you tap less, or you learn to defend better against certain attacks, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I know exactly where you're coming from. It's very valuable. It's very valuable.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. There was an article I was reading the other day about George St. Pierre. And George St. Pierre, I guess I think his first trip up from when he went from Quebec to New York, he went to train at Henzo's. I think it was Henzo's. And his first role, I guess, was with Sean Williams, the inventor of the Williams guard. And I think Sean had tapped him out like five times or something, and he was like ready to quit jiu-jitsu. And then I guess Sean Williams said something to him like, one day you'll be where I am. Of course, he's way farther advanced than Sean Williams is, of course. Like he didn't, you don't know who you're talking to or what someone's potential is all the time. So it's interesting. I don't know. I think when you're younger, when you start rolling, like younger in your jiu-jitsu journey, you think about it more as you progress. I don't really think about it because I remember the first time I ever tapped a black belt, I was a blue belt. So it's like, and then I don't think I tapped black belt again until maybe a couple times, but eventually purple belt. It's like you start bridging the gap and you start knowing more techniques, and then you tap out, as you get better at defending, you also tap out less, you go further before tapping than maybe you learn that line between danger and I should have tapped and I did tap and I tapped too early. It's more like that. I think it's not learning. Let me think of it this way. When you're a lower belt, tapping out is more like to learn technique and everything. But as you get more advanced, in my opinion, I think tapping out is more learning the extent of what your body can handle, what you can take without being injured or just minor injuries, if you think of it that way.
This was one of the big points for why I keep my kids in jiu-jitsu, and it goes with our theme. One of the big reasons I keep my kids in, and I've told Presbyte that, I'm like, look, they want to do soccer, they want to do dance, whatever. They can do all those other activities after jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu is non-negotiable. And the big thing is because it's this long exercise in calmness under pressure. Like you're getting literal pressure. You've got someone else your size literally bearing down on you, trying to choke the life out of you. And if you panic and you freak out, you're going to gas out in 2 seconds. But if you relax and you calm down, you realize, oh, I don't need to push my arms all the way. I only need like this much space for a frame. And if I relax, oh, well, I'm not going to suffocate. I can bump my way out. And, oh, man, this is really okay. Like, it's scary being on the bottom your first month, your first 3 months. You're freaking out every time you're down there. But then you start to realize, oh, the pressure is not going to kill me. I'm not going to suffocate. I'm going to be all right. So relax. Start to control your breathing. You bump up. You only need this much room to frame. I mean, they may or may not ever get into a real fight in their life, but mm-hmm. there's going to be tons of pressure. It'll be financial pressure, school pressure, assignments. There'll be work pressure. Life is going to bear down on them. And they've got a real life activity right now where they're practicing calm problem solving under pressure. That's a serious life skill. So whether or not they ever need to choke someone, they do need to be able to function under pressure without panicking. Mm-hmm. And to our point, that to me is that's the greatest value of jiu-jitsu for my kids. And that's why I keep them in there as opposed to like saying, well, let's try something else. Because it's one of the few arts that really provides that in just raw, 100%, no question mark about it, high resolution. It's one of the few places where you can get that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, great insight, great way of looking at it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's about character, right? It's the same reason why I tell my son, it's like, okay, obviously, if you hate something, I'm not going to force you forever to do it. But, you know, you're committed now, right? And you're committed at least for the first, when you started out at the beginning, I said, you're committed for a year. You're not committed for like a month. Right? You're committed for a year. You're going to do it for a year. And if you love it, then we can keep going. If you really, really hate it, okay, obviously I'm going to force my kid if they're depressed and really hate what they're doing. He loves it. Thank God, right? He loves it. But it's like, that's number one. That's number one, what you're doing. And now the other kids hopefully will get involved because it's about character. It's not just about, you know, doing it or, you know, just having activity for them, right? But the right type of activity that's going to build the right type of character traits in them. It's going to build personality. It's going to build, you know, integrity in them. It's going to build the life skills and coping skills, right, for real life. So, yeah.
Dare I say resilience, man? I mean, to go to our theme, yeah. Right? And I'll tell you, and humility too. And Father Thomas may or may not, I hope, this will ring true for you, being the senior most jiu-jitsu practitioner in the room. But the humblest, nicest guys I know are the competitive black belts. That absolutely, mm-hmm. because to get to where they are, they've been choked a million times, they've been armbarred a million times, they have no pretend bravado, like, and they know there's someone out there still choking them. They have a humility that comes from adversity and resilience, and they're really good, and they don't have to pretend they're good. They're really, really good. So there's no chip on their shoulder. It's just like, yeah, man, I know how to armbar someone. That's because I got armbarred a lot. There's something in that humility that's really strong, and that's what I find in our greatest Orthodox fathers, the people and mothers, the people who exemplify the spirituality of our church. That's how they are. There's no bravado. They're just like, oh, Father, well, how do you get so great at spiritual life? Well, I've messed up a lot. I've had to go to confession a lot. I've fallen into sin a lot. I've had to force myself to pray a lot. I mean, it's real transferable. So there's something there, man.
Yeah, and it's direct application too, right? It's not theoretical. That's what I love about it. You know, you mentioned you did karate when you were a kid, right? There's no katas in, in jiu-jitsu, right? Like, there's no theoretical, let me put together the martial arts ballet to get points or my next belt. You got it, you know, they throw you in with the wolves, right? It's like, here you go. Okay. If you think you can do it, if you say you can do it, if you think it's, that's what I love about it. Like, I don't see it in any other kind of martial art. Your instructor says, oh, you think you're a blue belt now? Okay. Show me. Okay. Defend, like, show, you know, show me the skill sets that you say you have. And if you can do it, you do it. If you don't, you don't. And it's, you can't lie about it. You can't pretend. So it's really real. And that's how life is. It's not going to do you any favors. People might do you favors sometimes, but life is not going to do you any favors. And you're going to either sink or swim. That's the way it is. So it's really applicable. It's on all levels.
Well, the truth will set you free, man. I mean, and that's the thing. Jiu-jitsu is one of those activities that's about truth. Because either either your guard, either your sweep worked or it didn't. Either your armbar worked or it didn't. Either your, you know, your transition worked or it didn't. You know, either you got up and said your prayers or you didn't. Either you studied the scriptures and the fathers or you didn't. Did you control your, you know, you got a bad temper in the morning. You know, either you controlled your temper with your wife and kids this morning or you didn't. I mean, this both the spiritual life and the jujitsu, it's this real raw thing where like you said, you know, the truth is there in front of you and you have to deal with it. And, you know, you either did or you didn't. And if you didn't, well, let's tighten things up and do it again.
And again, and again.
And again. Yeah.
Okay, well, wrapping up our conversation today with Father Michael Marcantoni and Father Thomas Sandberg about resilience, I really want to thank, first of all, Father Michael, you know, sharing his insight, sharing a little bit of his background in jiu-jitsu and also in the church. Father, do you have any kind of final thoughts, any kind of final reflections on, you know, your experience so far in your jiu-jitsu journey? You're kind of like, you're not at the beginning, but you're not at the end, right? You're kind of getting to that sweet spot, the middle time, you know, where people kind of tend to, they tend to compete and they tend to grow a lot and learn a lot of techniques and things like that. Do you have any final thoughts on this whole topic of, you know, learning from failure?
A little bit. So there's a great line in Saint Theophan the Recluse's book, Unseen Warfare, where he says that the only loser in the spiritual warfare is the one who quits, the one who stops fighting. And so one of his preconditions for like a spiritual life is to strive without ceasing. And so that's really the heart of resilience, this idea, especially in Orthodox Metanya and Orthodox repentance, that we have it built into the system that you're going to fail a lot. You're going to fall and get back up. You're going to fall and get back up. And it really doesn't matter that you fall. It matters that you get back up. You know, the failure is not nearly as important as what you do next. And that's the cornerstone, like whether you're reading the Desert Fathers or Newer Fathers or talking to your parish priest. It's like, yeah, okay, you know, the day didn't go the way you wanted. Your most habitual sins didn't go the way you wanted. Whatever. But what did you do next? Did you get back up? Did you fix it? Did you address it? Did you make amends? And if you did those things, fantastic. Drive forward. And that's kind of every parish, every good priest, every good bishop I've ever heard from, every good monk I've ever heard from, that's their attitude. The only person who ever really taps out is the one who gives up. And that's the only way you actually lose. And that's exactly how jiu-jitsu is. You know, your choke went right, your arm bar, your leg lock went right, fantastic. If it didn't, that's fine. It doesn't matter that you tap. It matters, what do you do next? Well, all right, well, tell me, hey, you know, if I'm rolling with Father Thomas and he snatches a knee bar on me 10 times in a row, it's like, all right, help me out. What am I doing wrong with my leg? Clearly, I'm doing something wrong. And then you help me and I get better. And what I did next helps me to be better tomorrow. The only way I lose is if I storm off the mat and say, I'm never showing up here again. Mm-hmm. So spiritual life and jiu-jitsu, man, it's all based on that thing where we're going to fall on our face 1,000 times. And what really matters is we get up 1,001. And I think it's really essential that everybody have something in their life that teaches them that. I just don't know a better place than in the mat or in the church. And those are lessons that we need big time. Because if you're just living in your head and doing theory, you can fall into a hubris real quick. And that's never good.
Oh, that was really great. That's really, really, really great insight. I really, 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 really like that.
Metanya, man, you know, like we use the word, but it's kind of funny. In the Orthodox tradition, we use the term metanya, change of mind, right, and repentance, and we always kind of hear that word and we think of, you know, something going on in our heads or, you know, feeling bad for something we've done and trying to change, but we also use the word for prostration, right? we say we do a metanya, you do a metanya, you do a prostration, right? Which is like, you know, you either do your cross and touch the ground, or you do your cross, you're down on your knees, touch your forehead to the ground and get back up again, right? So it's a physical form of prayer. And, you know, I asked a monk on Mount Athos, when I visited Mount Athos in 2002 when I graduated seminary, and I asked the monks, like, what's up with the metanyas? What's, you know, like, what, how do you view it? And he said, it's like, the metanya is just a physical representation of our spiritual repentance. So you remind yourself constantly that you need to, when every time you fall, you need to get back up again. And so we're just doing it over and over again with our bodies to remind us what should be happening in our minds over and over. You fall, you get back up, but you always finish up. That's the whole point. You never finish a metanya down. You never stay down in any kind of Orthodox service, any kind of typikon you see, always the metanya is always down and then up again. It's never up and then down. That would be called depression, you know, like, you know, so, katathemypsy in Greek. So, you know, it's always up. It's always oriented towards coming back up again. And that is exactly what I think, exactly what you were talking about. You know, it doesn't matter how your roll goes, whether it's good or bad, you're going to roll again. You know, you never stop rolling. It's like all the time, you know, you could have had a great week of rolling. You know, that next week it might be bad, right? That's okay. The week after that, it's going to be better. Like, it's just up and down, just like the spiritual life.
All right. I guess, Father Michael, thanks for having you on the show today. Where can people follow you? You're on OCN on Thursdays.
Wednesday nights. Thank you. Yes, you can. Yep. You can follow. I am on Wednesday night, 7 PM Wednesday night on OCN. I do a live stream there. That's 7 PM Central time. So okay. I guess that's 8 PM yep. Eastern time. On OCN live stream, and they keep that archived there. The program is called The Real Deal, and we try to, in that particular live stream, the aim is to touch on real world topics, real sort of like rubber meets the road sort of stuff, and how to apply theology. So it's actionable spirituality. Lately, the main topic has been recovery and addictions and things like that. We're talking a lot about that right now. So if that's helpful to anyone, OCN Wednesday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central. And of course, I sometimes do stuff over my own Facebook and I'll share things. So hope to see you there.
All right. Awesome. Great. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Father. It's been wonderful. And we hope to have you on again sometime in the future. And maybe... maybe if we're lucky, we can someday we'll see each other. We'll meet each other in person. Maybe we'll see each other on the mats too.
Oh, that would be phenomenal. I had a great time. This was just a phenomenal time with you fathers. And I would love to do this again and join you on this again. This was awesome. And yeah, I do hope we all get to meet in person, not just us, you know, our sons. Since we've got our boys doing jiu-jitsu, we could have a good group father-son rolling session. It'd be awesome.
Nice, nice. It's an opportunity to you visit Canada and we visit Nashville. So,
hey, man, I need an excuse for a vacation. Please give me an excuse.
Nice. Well, thank you again. And Father Thomas, thank you very much. And we'll see everybody in 2 weeks on our next podcast. God bless.
God bless you, fathers. Thank you.
You have been listening to The Fighting Priests, an independent podcast. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram and let us know your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. Till next time, keep training the body and the soul. God bless.